All right, thank you all for coming out. This is my second time at MIT. I don't know if any of you was here last time when I spoke a little bit about money. I am a moral theologian, which means I basically study ethics from a theological perspective, how to behave, why people behave the way they behave, the rules and ideas of the church that support those rules. My specialization is just war theory, and it's not like merely war theory. It means justified or justifiable war, right? Ethical war, which I'm sure some of you might strike you as oxymoronic. So I'm talking about the just war theory. That's where I'll start, and how it relates to thinking through some questions that might arise for those of you who are basically pursuing engineering or the kinds of occupations that would be associated with working with the Department of Defense or with companies who do business with the Department of Defense and so on. But I'm not going to approach this by making some sort of a priori claim, for instance, that it would always be immoral to pursue an occupation or to work with the Department of Defense and so on. I'll explain why I'm not doing that. And generally speaking, I don't find that very helpful. I long ago abandoned that practice as a moral theologian of just moralizing, telling people how to behave. Instead, I try to understand things and sort of think through frameworks of questioning. And by those frameworks, try to narrow down or focus questions in ways that might be helpful to people. I'm not avoiding that because it's impossible to do that with regard to certain kinds of industries or professions. And when I wrote my little outline and I made that point, I wrote that there are some professions that one should never get involved with. And the timing of this couldn't be better. I wrote down human trafficking and prostitution. Some of you may have heard today about Robert Kraft, right? The owner of your hometown team, right? There are certain kinds of professions that are simply bad, simply wrong, simply evil. We can talk about why that is the case if you guys want to, but I'm not prescinding from this because one couldn't do that with regard to certain kinds of professions. Human trafficking is simply a bad profession. There are good reasons why we think that, or most of us, I assume, think that. Maybe there's some disagreement. But I don't see research related to defense, the defense industry, the defense, and killing associated with defending people as that kind of industry. And I'm now going to explain why. We'll begin with the first assumption that I'm operating under with tonight, and that is the assumption that there are such things as just wars. There are such things as violent, lethal conflicts between nations or within nations occasionally, and that those can be understood to be pursuing genuine goods for human beings, okay? So, a much simpler way, right, as I was talking to Father and couple of students earlier, missionaries earlier, would be to say, look, that's simple. War is like prostitution, right? War is like human trafficking. It's simply evil. But that has not been the judgment of the Christian churches, by and large, with some exceptions, for their history. It's not been the judgment of much of civilization that's recorded historically, right? There are all kinds of justifications for it. It's not surprising we can go into any of those kinds of justifications. Generally speaking, right, people seem to agree that there are things that are like just wars, right? There are wars that are permissible, maybe even obligatory to participate in, and there are those that are not. So how does this theory operate, right? It's often called a theory. I generally will not use that term, okay? I think theory suggests way too much about its power and about what it's doing. But it is a specification over history. Over history, theologians, canon lawyers, priests who were hearing confessions, philosophers, inside and outside of the church, have specified the kinds of conditions associated with just wars. And they've done this in part by referring to three categories, okay? This will be familiar with probably this, to some of you. The first of these is something called right authority. I'm suggesting, and I argue tonight, I argue elsewhere in print, that really what these are specifications of practical reason. Okay, it's just practical reason, right? The way we think rightly about things applied to a specific kind of human activity. It's a corporate human activity, right? It involves more than one person, so you have to specify the authority associated with it. When I think about whether I'm going to enter into an occupation, whether I'm going to discipline my child, whether I'm going to assign a book in a classroom to my students, I am the agent, right? I am the authority. There's, generally speaking, no question about this. Maybe at home, my wife and I may have some, you know, there might be some contestation about who's the right authority in any particular circumstance. But generally speaking, in most of our lives, we are understood as the authority, right? I'm the agent right now. I'm the actor. I have freedom. This is my choice. I can justify it to you. Why I'm going to do this rather than that? Why I'm going to do anything at all? Because this is a corporate activity, and because in history there have been contests about who gets to make this judgment, this developed as a kind of specification. Who is actually the agent here? Okay, and the agent here needn't even be a singular person. It could be something like in the United States, Congress. Congress has the authority to declare war. Correct? Right? So it could be a body. As Father pointed out, sometimes you get into these like weird situations where you actually can't identify the person or persons who have made the judgment, but nonetheless, some sort of corporate entity is understood to do this. So this is the first criterion of this theory, of this trying to figure out how practical reason operates in this context, the context of war making, war deciding. What it does, too, is specify more or less the kind of act it is. Like any act, it is an act ordered towards some good. Right? All acts from this tradition we understand to be, you know, ordered towards some good, something we perceive to be good for us, right? I decide I'm going to start exercising, right? So I wake up at 6 o'clock in the morning and I run. It's not true. All right, so I wake up at 6 o'clock in the morning and I run, right? Why am I running? If somebody asks me, I can tell them, well, for the good of exercise. For the good of, course, nobody speaks like that. Maybe, you know, so few people speak like that, right? But, right? Most of us don't talk that way. I want to get fit, right? I want to be fitter. I want to lose weight, right? But in other words, it's health, something about health. Health is a good, right? The act is completely intelligible. Everybody understands it. Oh, I understand why Capizzi's, you know, he's crazy. It's cold outside. You know, the bed covers are warm, and yet he's getting out and he's running. That all makes sense to me, right? He's the authority. He specified a good. The good is intelligible. The means to the good all make sense, right? We all get that kind of thing. If I was, you know, going to grab a bowl of ice cream or whatever, and somebody said, what are you eating ice cream for? I said, for my health. I'm getting fit, right? It loses intelligibility. I may perceive it as a good. You'd all say you're wrong about the good, right? But we understand this. In this context, however, the good is different. Okay, the good is different. It's a political good. It's a good of a polis. It's a good of a community. And not just any community, not like the bowling club, not like the New England Patriots, you know, nation, or whatever you guys call yourselves up here, right? It's not that kind of community. It's a specific kind of community. It's a political community. It's a community of citizens. It's a community of people within a nation. Okay? And they have a particular good, a good that's particular to themselves. It's associated with all the kinds of things that we angle about in our culture right now. Borders, right? Prosperity, qualifications for citizenship, whether there should even be such things, right? Capacity for employment, taxation, and so on, right? All of these things are pertain to the political good, the good of us as members of the community, even those of us who are potential members of the community, you know, the children that may come into a community over time. So, this is not just any authority. Because it's a political good, it has to be a political authority. That political entity that has as its charge the pursuit of the good of that community. Right? So, I can't say the United States is declaring war on France on behalf of the yellow vested people, right? We're now intervening on their behalf. Why? Well, because Capizzi said so, right? I have no authority at all, no standing. We all recognize that. But the U.S. government does have that authority. They have responsibility for this good, including defending that good, right? So the authority attaches very closely to the good that's being defended, maintained, advanced, pursued by that authority, recognized as such. And over time, there were all kinds of arguments about this. Before the nation state emerges, you have dukes and princes and kings arguing about who is in fact in authority, right? There were great, you know, moments in history where a duke or a prince might contest the authority of somebody who appeared to be the authority simply by virtue of his own capacity to claim, I'm now in authority here, right? I can muster a military to challenge you. This gets specified over time. Right authority is a kind of critical claim. It cannot, however, from this perspective, determine the justice of its claims on its own. Okay? It measures those by something beyond itself. It measures those claims by natural justice, right? By the conception of justice itself. It will make the judgment, this is the time. Now's the time to defend ourselves. Now's the time, not the time to defend ourselves. But it has to do that in context of, you know, some sort of aversion to justice. This is the principle of just, and you might say sufficient, cause. Right? So, you have to determine that there is a cause now that brings the occasion for us to now think about whether this is the right kind of action, whether, you know, the use of military force is in fact permissible at this moment. Just here refers to justice. Okay, is there some cause, right, that has been violated, something that has been violated in justice that now we are permitted to respond to, okay? And sufficient, is, which is almost never included, just reminds us that it can't be something insignificant. It has to be a cause that on its own rises to such a level that war becomes conceivable as a response, right? The use of lethal violence becomes conceivable as a response to this action. Generally speaking, throughout history, right, this is included attack, right? Your own borders have now been crossed by a belligerent. You have the capacity to defend yourself against it. Almost always, even in international law, defense against unjust aggression, the language of justice again, is recognized as a just and often sufficient cause for defensive response with lethal force. Over in history, there have been other causes that have been permissible, again, if they were sufficient, like reparation for prior damages. If one country or one army took something, harmed another political good, you could actually fight a punitive war against them. You could fight to punish them for having done that, both in terms of, you know, sort of sending them the message, what you did was wrong, now here's your sort of just punishment for it, also in terms of repairing what was done, maybe recapturing some land, maybe damaging their military, damaging their capacity to attack in the future. So just and sufficient cause is critical to this. It excludes certain kinds of causes, like glory. Glory is not a permissible cause according to this, nor is national honor. nor is expansion of borders, national aggrandizement, retribution no longer is permitted according to international law. These are developments, these are more contemporary developments. Like I said, in the past, it was permitted. Lust, imperial lust, right? You know, just the desire to over, you know, expand yourself, your empire. This, of course, was something that motivated Mussolini in North Africa, right, in the early 20th century. Those kinds of causes are excluded by this. They're excluded by justice. Okay, justice recognizes that these are not causes for not only war, they're not actually causes for any political action. That, you know, those would all be prohibited. Those would all be prohibited not simply because they can't justify war. They're prohibited as acts of politics. And one of the bigger claims here that might actually become interesting to talk about tonight is that this account, which is really, I think, not just a Catholic account, but I also think it is a kind of classic Catholic account, is not a nationalist account. And if you're reading any political theory these days, you know, especially in Catholic circles, you're seeing a reemergence of some conceptions of nationalism. And I think that we need to be really careful about embracing those as Catholics. This is not the Catholic perspective on this. It's not, in fact, nationalist. Again, justice is framing all of this. And there's a claim. There's a claim, on the one hand, that there is a political good. Every, you know, in our language today, nation state has a real political good. The United States of America has a political good. But there's also a good beyond that, and that is the good of the international community of which these nations are a part. Oops. This, from the Catholic perspective, again, not just the Catholic perspective, that is a real thing. There is a good of the international community. And that helps us understand and measure any of the actions of any particular political community. Was there a hand up there? Yes.
Sorry, well, actually, you just answered my question. I was going to ask if the defense of an ally was a justifiable cause. And I guess I want to bring up that World War I was a series of those. And that is interesting because under this definition, World War I is completely justified.
From which perspective?
All perspectives, because the nations that got involved in the conflicts came to the aid of their allies.
Right.
Therefore, they would have done that under perhaps the reason that it would have benefited the greater community. Some other justification.
Yeah. I'm not sure that this is getting at what you're saying, but from this perspective, okay, from this perspective where you have something like, maybe I'll use this, okay, you have, right, different nations, correct? And they're going to make allegiances, relationships with each other and so on, right? Okay? We understand that, right? You know, here's the U.S., here's France, here's Indonesia, whatever, right? And they make relationships with each other. And sometimes the relationships are even sort of kind of in conflict with relationships they may have with other places. That in itself could be a model, right? And in fact is a model of international relations. And you might even call it like the voluntarist model. What becomes important in this account is what you assent to, right? What any particular nation assents to. I have a relationship with France, or the United U.S. has a relationship with France. We're now bound by that, okay? And that treaty, that agreement, and so on, compels us to defend France against attack from some, you know, somebody else. From the account that I'm describing, and I hope this is getting at what you're saying, there's another community, okay, that actually exists, that is a real community, and that's the community of the nations, right? They have a common good, in other words, as nations. And theoretically, and more practically, the claim is, right, those are all alignable, okay? because they're ordered towards something that is truly just. Right? So if France acts in a way that is contrary to the good of the whole thing, and the United States has an agreement with France, we're going to defend you guys if you're attacked, right? Or if, you know, you find yourselves fighting a war. But France has now done something that is a violation of the just cause, right? It could become a cause itself for somebody else to attack or defend against France. We would not be bound by that agreement. France would have more or less broken that agreement by their own activity, by their unjust activity. We would not be, therefore, just in defending France, even though we had a prior agreement. This is a long way of saying, from this perspective, right, when you have this kind of conception of justice that becomes a measure of all actions, much as that conception of justice measures my own actions as an individual, right? There can never be two just causes in a war. You couldn't say that, right, that on the one hand, right, the United States is just in participating in a lethal conflict against Axis powers, right? On the other hand, so too are the Axis powers just in defending themselves against, the American alliance and so on, right? Even where it might look like, I'm sorry, I'm grabbing water. Even where it might look like you have a situation where everybody's just in participating in a conflict, both sides of a war, a conflict, are actually justified, that could not be the case. Now, it is true, right, that in most of human living, things aren't really that black and white. There's going to be some injustice associated with one party, or we can go back and say, well, the U.S. was acting provocatively, or France was acting provocatively, right, and wonder about whether that provocation had some part to play in the conflict, right? I mean, things are mixed, right? We're Augustinian in that respect, right? These goods are mixed goods. You'd still be able to determine that one party, in fact, had violated justice to such an extent that the conflict was permitted and another one had not. Is that getting at, yes, please.
I'm thinking, just to back up your point and reinforce it, with the very specific example that this gentleman chose,
right,
in July and August of 1914, purely for reasons of state, when Austria-Hungary threatened Serbia with an ultimatum, there were a whole series of nations that said, I'm treaty-bound for reasons of state to back up my partners.
Right.
Where the just cause comes in is that Britain, France, and Germany were major signatories to an international treaty for international good, preserving the neutrality, the territorial integrity of Belgium. Once the German troops crossed into Belgium, they had violated international law, and as their chancellor infamously said, it's a mere piece of paper. So the Germans said, we no longer care about international law and international good. At that point, France and Britain were observing just war criteria to come into the war. So that might be a specific example why you had two competing alliances, but not two competing just causes.
Right. Great. Thank you very much. And it's a great point to bring up, right, because it allowed me to do this, right, and to remind ourselves that this is a model for thinking about these problems, right? This model where you have, again, an overarching conception of justice, you have a notion that supports international law as a genuine thing, even when international law doesn't exist, right? So this is if you go back to the earlier tradition of people who are arguing these points, before Grotius even, right, like Vittoria, Suarez, or the great Spanish scholastics, and you don't really have international law codified the way it is now, they're already arguing. Right, that's a positive deficiency, right? But it's not an actual deficiency, right? There already are these things. Just Jensium is what they appeal to more or less to make the case that people recognize these things. That the disparate nations recognize that they have obligations to each other that are independent of any actual agreements they have made with each other, and sometimes those are for great reasons, right? Vittoria famously argues against the right of the Spaniards to dispossess the native populations of the Americas of their properties, right? right? Yay for Vittoria, right? That's great stuff, right? On the other hand, he argues that they can't resist, right? The native populations can't resist the Spaniards' efforts at trade, right? Or they're coming in and, you know, making use of resources that the native populations aren't making use of, right? Which is maybe a little bit more boom for Vittoria, right? But it's complicated, right? It's a tough one, right? But so you get to see that this is one model. The other model, the model where I called it voluntarist, which is what the older Catholic tradition used to refer to it as, is really powerful, right? That's a model that almost reflexively a lot of Americans really sort of think. The United States will determine what its good is, and it will do so by, you know, more or less democratic-republican processes, and it will do so first, right? And then think about maybe obligations it has to the rest of the world, to you know, regional partners that it might want to make, to, you know, international partners, but it would deny that there's any sort of international good, right, that's obliging, and it might even deny that there's anything like international justice, right, that's sort of out there and has some bearing on us. If it exists, right, it only exists in a very, very minimalist sense, and it's really based on agreements that we enter into, which we can also dissolve when it accrues to our good. That's a really powerful position, and like I said, I think a lot of us kind of understand it, right? We kind of sympathize with that perspective. This one does not. This one does, or at least that's what I would argue against some of my colleagues who might be embracing a different perspective on this. Okay, so that's just a quick, you know, look at just cause. Okay, and again, we can talk about in any specifics associated with it. The last important criteria for thinking through this is, at this point, is right intention. And if you think about action again, right, just individual action, you get more or less what's going on here, right? There you go. Authority. Who's the authority? I am as an individual, or some corporate authority is responsible for the political good. A cause is basically occasion for the action, right? Like, why am I doing this, right? Intention is asking that, well, what do I seek by this activity, right? I sought health before by running in the morning. Sorry, yes, please.
So you're saying that it isn't proper to do the right thing for the wrong reason.
It isn't proper to do the right thing for the wrong reason. Yeah, that's right. I'll buy on that. Generally speaking, right? Generally speaking. Depends upon the good or something. Right. So, right intentionality, okay? Well, it's, of course, complicated, that question, right? Right intention here, again, it's a corporate activity. And the intention of political actors is always peace. Okay, this is the point Augustine makes in multiple places, including a letter he writes to a Roman governor, and also, of course, in the City of God. Why does anybody seek war or conflict? They seek it for what they perceive to be peace, right? If you watch The Godfather, right, you know, why does he eliminate the heads of the five families, right? Because he wants peace, okay? So it's, peace is why we do what we're doing with this kind of thing, right? It seems, again, almost contradictory to say, why are you going to war? We're going in the pursuit of peace. But on the one hand, we kind of get it historically. If you look at, you know, certain instances in history, it makes sense. And you can also get it in terms of the normativity of the conception of peace here, right? Peace here is not simply like the cessation of conflict. It's in fact something that is in service to the good up here, this international good, and therefore to your state, your nation as well. Right? If it doesn't serve that, it doesn't serve your nation. If it doesn't serve, right, in other words, the goods of other nations as well, right, it won't be actually in service to your nation's peace. So it's actually a powerful normative conception. All of this, right, is again in the service of saying sometimes the use of lethal force can be permissible, right? We can be allowed to do this. We can be enlisted soldiers, right, as politicians. We can call on those soldiers to get, you know, to gather their arms and bring lethal force against some other population, some other nation that has committed some, you know, an act, an injury, caused an injury to us that needs to be repelled, that needs to be stopped, that may even need to be turned back. Okay? That's what it all is in service of. This is then a, not a pacifist account. If it were a pacifist account, the answer about working in the STEM, right, industries that are associated with the Defense Department and so on, right, would answer itself. No, you can't do that. Yeah.
Explain the difference between the just cause and the retaliation.
Yeah. Cause is some harm that's been done, right?
Ah.
Yeah, it's basically, right, there's been an injury.
Ah, okay. So, okay. So you can't just go to war with the intention of having peace.
Right, that's right. That's right. Right, because we all, right, that's right. So Michael Corleone, right, like, you know, he would have to sit, sort of say there were violations of justice, right, that allowed him to go after, the, you know, the other heads of the families. The United States, right, Trump, right, can't say, well, let's just create a peaceful place by getting rid of the Japanese, right? Right, they have to have done something in order to for us to bring violence to bear against them, sir.
Corleone wasn't right authority, though.
He wasn't right authority, for sure, and he was not operating within the boundaries of justice.
Would a preemptive attack be a just cause?
Yeah, would a preemptive attack be a just cause? You know what's great about this? Those kinds of questions, which, of course, came up in 2001, 2002, and, you know, they're real questions, came up much earlier in the tradition, right? So you go back and you can find early Christian theologians and Jewish, right, rabbinic tradition asking these same kinds of questions. There's a great and disturbing book about the Mossad, right? I don't know, was it Rise and Kill First, which is a rabbinic saying. If somebody comes in, you know, if somebody comes to get you, rise and kill first, I think is the title. I mean, it's worth looking at if you have interest in that kind of thing. But so that would be a, like all of this, okay, to your question, it's an exercise of political practical reason. Sometimes yes, and sometimes no. So not always no. And the issue would be, or the kinds of things you'd be thinking about are first this. Do I have the authority to do this? Who's in authority, right? What is the good being served here? Right, which is down here, like, you know, right? What is the good, right? What is the intention of this? Peace. If they are, right, they have not yet committed the injury. This is what makes this a challenging question, right? The injury has not yet been committed. But we know that they are about to do that, or we have, you know, a pretty clear certitude that they're about to do that. So let's say, for instance, that right, Poland could have done something, had a sense that Germany was about to cross its border, right, August 30th, and had a sense that this is going to be devastating if we wait. Right, so you can see, like, I'm trying to, you have to think prudentially, like, number one, can we do anything? Number two, how devastating is it going to be if we wait for them to hit us? Or how much advantage might we gain by hitting them first? It's coming. The hit is coming. We know it's coming. But if we can hit them first, maybe we gain some advantage, right? In that kind of situation, maybe, right? I work sometimes with Israeli scholars, right? And Israel, of course, perceives, we talk about this all the time, right? Perceives itself as surrounded, right? And it perceives itself surrounded by hostile governments, and it perceives that those governments aren't kind of playing around, right? They are interested in a pretty severe damaging, maybe even existential damaging to Israel as a nation. What that's showing you is that the gravity of the conflict is very high. And for a lot of these guys will argue, therefore, it lowers the barrier to preemptive action. This is why Israel thinks, you know, justifies preemptive action, not just against military people, but people working in industries like those that you, some of you work in, right, that assist the military. We can't wait for the, you know, Iran to get a nuclear weapon, right? They may already have one anyway, right? But we can't, right? We can't wait for that, so we'll take out some of their physicists, scientists, etc., right? And as a kind of preemptive action against it, because we know what this is ordered towards. Ma'am, you had a question. Yes.
If this may not be an appropriate way to apply, but what, let's say we took a look at Venezuela, the present situation in Venezuela, with the data that we know. What is the what would the just war theory say about, you know, we just sent a bunch of planes over there and obliterated the place?
Yeah, well.
It's a serious question.
I think one way to approach the question, it's not the only way to approach the question, would be asked like the right authority question. Sometimes what happens, right, in the world is you have a political authority, at least in some sense, maybe not any longer a moral sense, right, but you have somebody who's in political power. It could be a king, right, a queen, an elected official, who now becomes more or less a tyrant, right? By definition, somebody who, by definition, tyranny is understood, or tyrant is understood as that person or persons who are no longer pursuing the political good of their people. They're pursuing a private good. Okay, so Maduro or whomever, right? No, arguably is not morally any longer a right authority. He cannot morally then defend himself against attack. He cannot morally marshal his troops in order to attack somebody else, like shoot on his own population, like happened today, right? Close borders, the border to Brazil, etc. Right? What he's doing is measured by justice, wronged. So you have now you have a series of prudential options to you. What are the injuries here? Possible injuries could be injuries to his own people, right? He's now acting against his own people. Like, you know, arguably, right, that was one of the claims made against Saddam Hussein in 01, 02, right? He's harming his own people. That could become, arguably, right, a cause for an action that pursues peace by some other authority. Okay, this is the tough stuff, right, where you get into issues of, like, humanitarian intervention, or what's called R2P, right to protect, somebody else who by justice has the capacity and the authority, international community, a regional community, Organization of African States, right, you know, somebody else might have the authority now to intervene to protect those people against what's become basically illegitimate authority. So I think this might be how you start to think about that. Does the United States have the authority right now to do something against Venezuela? Pretty clearly not, in my judgment, right? And I think probably by our judgment, were we to look at this, you know, right? I mean, obviously the crisis is severe. I don't want to go too much into depth of that. I think that that's probably self-evident, more or less, that we don't have that authority. If we thought that it was necessary to intervene, our first step would have to be what it's been, what it was even for Bush, right? Got to go to the international community. Now, of course, right, Bush disregarded what a large part of the international community said when he turned to them. But you kind of have to go at this point, given international law, given the claim, right? The claim is, right, there's no longer authority there. Somebody has to act. The first step has to be go to a regional community, international community, and ask, you know, like, or raise the issue. I saw some other hands. Sorry, you with the hat, yeah.
Well, I was curious about how would just war theory look at manifest destiny or Laban's Realm?
Laban's Realm clearly is bad. Like I said,
Manifest destiny is clearly bad.
Um, I forgot to repeat the question. How would this approach look at manifest destiny, Laban's realm type issues? Governments, right. I mean, those would both really vex it, right? They would probably be difficult to justify from this perspective. They're both aggrandizing claims. Hitler's claims at the time were really intelligible, right? I mean, not anything to do with the final solution, but they're kind of like Putin's right now. We've got German nationals who were kind of crazily divided up by prior political judgments. Some of them are in the Sudetenland, right? Some of them are in Austria. Some of them are in Poland. This doesn't make any sense. The Lebensraum claim was a little bit beyond that, right? About once we unify these people, right, in order to, you know, to be the, you know, there were national and racial claims being made simultaneous to it or associated with it. That's not unlike the manifest destiny claims in some respects, right? I think this theory would be condemnatory of both of those kinds of claims, and maybe in different ways. Two more questions, okay? And then I'll get you in a minute, okay? We'll move forward a little bit.
Is proportionality or accomplishing your political objectives with the minimum possible violence part of this theory?
Yes, it is. Okay. Yeah. we can talk about that more.
Well, that was what I was... Yeah. I was going to say there were three words in that question a little bit earlier.
Right.
Obliterate the place. And so reasonable means is part of the theory. And another thing that you may not have time to talk about is also... the probability of success being part of the theory as well.
Right, and all of that stuff I understand to be built at the right intention, okay? But it's all good stuff, okay? The intention has to be peace. And the first principle, or the principal, the most important principle for international law is the principle of discrimination, or what's all, you know, called the principle of distinction in international law. And that's between combatants and non-combatants. So the obliterate the place type language, right, is morally condemned by this approach. Okay? And it's this approach that also sort of thinks that weapons and strategies have to be ordered towards minimal damage and also cannot be directed against civilian populations. Okay? And there's a lot baked into that language, and we'll get into it, I'm sure, in questions and answers. But all of our strategies, all of our technologies have to be ordered towards proportionate, right, costs borne by the population of the wrong place, or even the soldiers of the wrong place, and the party, you know, in the wrong, and discriminate. We cannot intend to attack their people. Now, there's good reasons to question that. Orwell has a famous essay about, like, you know, why people care about whether children and women are killed, but it's an interesting and powerful point. We'll get to that, I think, in a minute. Okay, let's go. I want to make a couple of more points real quick. Okay, what I try to establish is, from this perspective, we can kill in the context of war. Some of you may disagree with that, but this is this perspective. This raises this issue. Presumably, you're not interested in working for the Defense Department or in industries associated with it if you're a pacifist. But maybe I'm wrong about that. There are approximately 1 in every 10 engineers works in the defense or defense-related industries. There are 39,000 39,000 electrical engineers, or about 14% of all electrical engineers, work for the Defense Department or defense-related industries. 6,000 aerospace engineers, which is almost 20% of aerospace engineers, work for defense-related industries. Okay, this is a real issue. Right, if you're getting into this business, right, if you're here at, you know, you guys are called the engineers, right? If you're here at MIT, presumably you're open to not only, while you're here, benefiting from the federal government's investment in your education, but also pursuing a career in this, right? This is not abstract. This is right there. Most of these engineers are civilians, okay? Of course, not all of them are. Some are in uniform, but most are civilians. This, you know, kind of mix of civilian and uniformed engineers provide, you know, unique angles on these questions. And the work done by engineers is comprehensive, They design new, more lethal and effective weaponry. They maintain that weaponry. They adjust them for conditions as the weapons are traded or sold to new nations, right? These weapons, right? It's not like they roll them out and the only United States uses them and they're used as is. Often they are distributed around the world and engineers will follow the weapons. Okay, they'll go to Saudi Arabia. They will go to Egypt. They will go to Israel and work with them, adjusting them, maintaining them, right, making them better, faster, right, more lethal, whatever is necessary. So y'all are all in on this stuff, okay? I'm not, by the way, just to be clear. And in the future, we'll be able to tell by comparing paychecks. Okay? But engineers are also like a universal community as well, okay? They're also a universal community. Engineering is a thing. And I don't mean to pick on engineers, right, but it just seemed apt, again, given the mascot. Engineering is a thing. I'm not making some claim about, you know, the good of its community and so on. I'm not that, you know, interested in that. But it is a community. There are universal standards to it. When you enter into engineering, what you are pursuing is the same thing as the engineers in Iran, the engineers in North Korea, and so on, right? You're all doing something understood as engineering and more or less the same kinds of things. They may be working in more primitive conditions than, you know, you guys will or are, but other than that, they're doing the same stuff. And by that, you have a kind of allegiance to each other. You know what good engineering is and you know what bad engineering is. You know what engineering for good purposes is and what it is for bad purposes. This permits engineers an opportunity, and engineers, of course, have seized this, to work on universal standards. You know, what should be the standards of good engineering? What should be the standards of engineers who work in cooperation with defense industries and so on? There are opportunities to think about the kinds of weapons that are developed, how to make those weapons more discriminate, more proportionate, less damaging short-term or long-term, or to think about all those kinds of questions, like landmines, right? Like, what are we going to do with these things once they're done? Is there a way to make them, right, eventually incapacitate themselves over time and so on, right? These are opportunities for engineers. So that doesn't justify the participation in the thing, right? What does, more or less, is the operation of practical reason, okay? You thinking about, what am I doing here now with what I'm working on? I don't know what you do, right? I don't. We've already agreed that the defense of a nation is sometimes good, right? The defense against aggression, against bad actors, is sometimes a good. That has to be done in the context we work in with lethal weaponry, including, right, and up to nuclear weapons, right? Those exist. They need to be maintained. Who's maintaining those? Who's working on, maybe even in this room, right? Associated technologies that are not only maintaining those, but are pushing those towards greater lethality. When they first came into existence, nobody thought of them as even potentially discriminate. Now we think of them as potentially discriminate weapons. They're thought of very differently than when they first appeared. So just those facts raise certain kinds of questions. I'm not going to answer them. I just want to bring them to our attention and we can think through them together. First, like immoral technologies. Are there technologies that might in themselves be immoral? What if you are asked to participate in the creation, development, advancement of technologies understood as immoral because they are designed to cause as much human suffering as possible? And I don't mean simply indiscriminate suffering. What if you are asked to participate in the development of a technology whose design is to cause the soldier as much physical suffering as possible before or regardless of whether he dies? There are technologies like this. There have been developed such technologies. You can think of biological and chemical weapons and why, right, the international community has prohibited their use, because their design often is not to kill, but to cause widespread suffering and pain, right? Great pain to people. How might those kinds of questions, right, differ from the kind of general questions we've asked so far tonight? Historically, one way to think about answering these kinds of questions is to revert to the neutrality of the technologies. Technologies are just instruments, right? Weapons are merely instruments. How people choose to use them is beyond me to determine, right? I can participate in this morally. My conscience is clear because I don't know how somebody intends to use this, right? A sword can become a plowshare. Right? I designed it to be as sharp as possible, as heavy as possible, so the cut would be as lethal as possible. But if somebody uses it as a plowshare, you know, that's beyond me. If somebody, I made a rake for baling hay. The last thing I thought of was the peasants were going to use it to storm the castle, right? You know, that's instruments that I design and make are simply neutral. And as engineers, we can wash our hands of how they are used by governments, what our people decide to use them for. That's not my decision. That language of mere instrumentality or neutrality with regards to instruments and technologies is very common. You see that everywhere. It's a little bit like the guns, you know, don't kill people. People kill people kind of thing, right? We don't choose what people are going to do with their guns. If they choose to use them, you know, to kill other people, that's awful. But, you know, I thought maybe they might hang it over their mantle, right? But some weapons, right, by their design seem to kind of confound that easy thinking, right? Some weapons by their design seem to confound that easy neutral instrumentality thinking. And those are the kinds of weapons I've already described. Some, by their disproportionate nature, right? They seem to be devastating, designed against populations with the intention of damaging a civilian population as much as possible, being as widespread in the damage and as long-lasting, not simply, right, to blow a bunch of people up, but actually to affect the area for generations, potentially. Technology is designed to poison or to otherwise make uninhabitable certain kinds of places. You know, poisoning, of course, is an old technology. Poisoning water supplies to places. These are, by their design, intended against civilian populations. It would seem like we could think about prohibiting participation in that even the technologies themselves. And of course, there have been movements to prohibit certain kinds of technologies. What about working with rogue regimes? Okay, so one category is thinking about working with immoral technologies or technologies. Can technologies be immoral? Another would be something like working with rogue regimes. Regimes that we know are politically unstable. We know are not interested in either their own regional communities or the international community's good. Can I work with those? You know, how would I think through whether my participation or my university's participation is justifiable? What would be the process of thinking through whatever the country is, whatever the regime is, that it somehow is such a volatile actor, is not bearing the right intentionality in its actions, is not arguably even a right authority? Does it in some way actually operate as a right authority wherever it is? Could I work with them? I think there are good reasons to think about that one could not. So these are just a couple of categories for thinking through these kinds of things. You guys could probably tell me, if you're working in any of these kinds of things, about particular challenges that arise with certain kinds of technologies. Canon lawyers in history, theologians, philosophers, think through these things right now. Okay, we're thinking about all these kinds of things. Certain kinds of technologies that are in development. Like I said, the activity of discriminant action in war itself, which this account prohibits, other accounts do not. Okay, other accounts do not. Remember, like, the shock and awe attack approach is not generally about discriminate or proportionate act, you know, action. Is that too old for some of you guys? Right. The shock and awe approaches are more like the sort of political realist approach. Knock them out, right? You go, come out swinging in the first round, knock them out as hard as you can, right? Don't try to fight a war that's moral, because a moral war, a war that's just, right, is oxymoronic. There is no such thing. Once you've entered into this, once you agree that there's a good worth defending, right, all bets are off at that point. And so, right, working with industry at that point is justifiable. We're just trying to win. We're going to win by having the smartest, brightest people working on these things. Anyway, so I want to finish there. I know we're kind of running out of time, but as I said, I have no, like, sort of, you know, broad a priori answers to these questions. These are questions that maybe some of you will face directly as your own work proceeds. As voters, of course, we face these questions as we think about how to approach our, you know, defense of ourselves. I try to describe the principles of practical rationality that are at bear here, okay? These are them. Who is in authority? What is the injury? What is, right, to respond to the question, right? What is the injury that we're responding to? Does it rise to a level, right, that merits a certain kind of lethality as a response? And does our activity actually seek peace? If you're pursuing things that cannot be fit into this, right, you're pursuing from this perspective immoral things, unjust things, whether it's the actual lethal activity itself or certain kinds of technologies that would confound any of those things. So I'll stop there. I hope there are some more questions. I know I ignored one in the back. I'll start back there if you still got it. Thank you.
Yeah, so just a question. So you use, like, the conditions for war, justice, like, right against authority.
Yeah.
They all seem like very soft sort of abstract concepts, and they can be sort of easily manipulated by states. You can see, like, states do this where they have propaganda that will justify,
right,
sort of this, their own people. So, I feel the system seems like it works for each country separately, because,
right,
each country will have its own sort of justice. But internationally, it seems like everyone's justice would be
liquid. Great. Okay, so the question is, began with by saying that these criteria seem a little soft, right? And they seem manipulable because they're soft. And that any country can justify more or less what it wants and fit its claims into the criteria. Yeah, that's kind of true, right? I think that that's obvious and a good point. And certainly, this is what countries do, right? So we even had an Operation Just Cause, right, in the United States, right? You know, where you get to announce, you know, hey, the cause is just. Well, why? Well, because we said so, right? Like, you know, and we know that criterion exists, so what do you want from us, right? We're doing, right, like, we're doing what you guys more or less counsel us to do. But that's not only true of political actors, it's true of us, right? It's true of any of us, that if you ask me why I'm doing something that you think of as wrong, I'm going to give you probably a pretty good account of why I'm doing what I think is wrong. I mean, I don't want to speak for Robert Kraft, right? But Robert Kraft is going to give it, you know, or his attorneys speaking for him, are going to give a pretty good account of why he was where he appeared to be and how it was, you know, like, whatever. I mean, like, I mean, not maybe to justify, like, the sexual activity with a prostitute, but why he's not, therefore, involved in human trafficking, right? Didn't know about it, had, you know, a false conception of what the good was here or something, right? That's all true. And because states, not only do we live in an age, right, where we kind of all defer to each other's conception of what is good or bad, right, but states even more so, the reason war exists, right, and the reason why the tradition has said state, you know, those in political authority, not just states, but because, again, in the past it wasn't states, but those in political authority had authority was because there was nobody to appeal to. Right? There's nobody to appeal to. They know the problem. Right? So the king of Spain, or the queen of Spain, thinks her activity is justified. Right? The native populations don't so much. Right? And they're going to argue, no, we're actually justified. Who do you appeal to? There's no recognized authority to appeal to. You kind of get this argument. Well, what Vittoria and these guys say is justice still obliges, right? There is still justice, even in this kind of, right, the anarchic world of nation states or political authorities competing against each other. Justice still applies. We can't appeal to a judge to decide this. But Vittoria actually, he gave these lectures on these, and one of them, I think it was De Indies, on the Indians, says the authority that thinks of itself as just has to act like a judge, actually has to sort of rise above its own good, it has to kind of rise out of this into this. It has to make this exercise of trying to see things as much as possible. Now, look, we're going to question whether they can do that and so on, right, and how much bias there might be. But he understood, nonetheless, that's what has to happen. I have to look at justice and see whether what I'm doing actually is for this good. If it's for this good, then it will be for my good. If it's not for this good, then it's not only not for the good of the native populations, the Indians, right? It's not good for us either. So it's a challenge. It'll always be there, right? But that's just the challenge of like human rationalization. The power of our own goods and how it bears on our own desires and how they bear on us. And as evidence that it works a little bit is we do actually have international law now. And we have international law that prohibits certain kinds of nasty stuff that human beings can do to each other and will do to each other in violation of the law, right, still. Right, but the law even recognizes this. The law prohibits indiscriminate activity by militaries, even in their own defense. Okay, that's a huge achievement. Will we do it when push comes to shove? Will we drop weapons that are indiscriminate on other populations? Probably, if we feel we have to. We will have violated not only the moral law when we do that, even the international laws. But so it's a constant challenge. Right here first, then we call it. Yeah.
So about the morality of the soldier himself who is fighting in the war. How culpable is he for the poor decisions of the authorities that send him to fight? Like, how does that kind of tie in?
Right. So there are different ways of asking it. Like, one would be simply like, I'm a German Wehrmacht soldier, right? And this account. How culpable am I as a soldier, right? This account more or less recognizes it's not my job to determine whether this is now the right war to fight. So I take up my gun and I fight on behalf of my nation, which is a good, right? It's a good to fight on behalf of your community. Even though in this case it's actually the unjust nation. From the perspective of morality, right, you would probably say he doesn't know a critical feature that would have told him what he was doing was unjust. Therefore, he's not culpable for his unjust activity. There's an interesting literature that's developed in analytic philosophy. Jeff McMahon has written on this a bit, and some of his students have written on this, which really questions that absence of culpability, wants to say that person is, of course, acting immorally. The Catholic account, this account has, generally speaking, not made that judgment. If the person didn't, like, sort of have the capacity to know, right, that the situation was unjust, didn't have available to them that information. But it's a great and difficult question for this account, though.
All right. Well, let's thank our speaker.